This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Across Northern Ireland, on your radio and on BBC Sounds. This is
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Good morning, everybody. A big political day for people in Northern Ireland as they evaluate 1 year into the day whether Stormont is delivering or not. And will it deliver in the next 12 months? Lots of politicians, lots of you on commenting. We like the news, we like politics in Northern Ireland, and we're talking about it big time on the biggest show in the country this morning.
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Good morning, everyone. So, 1 year since the return of Stormont. And look, there will always be bumps in the road of any government. But one of the questions we're asking today is whether you believe your politicians have acted with integrity over the last year. What they have achieved, has that been enough? And right off the bat this morning, I want you to use the Nolan Show as your platform to spell out the priorities for year two. Right from today, for the next 12 months. It's a fair media exercise to scrutinise last year on this day today, but we are about empowering your voice so that you can list out what they should be doing to affect the lives of your kids, your mum and dad, you, over the next 12 months. Pick up the phone, 030 30 80 55 55. We were repeatedly told that people in Northern Ireland would be better off with locally elected politicians making decisions for us. Has that been the case? 030 30 80 55 55. Top of the show this morning, I've been speaking to the Alliance Party MLA, Owen Tennyson, and the TUV leader, Jim Allister. I began by asking Owen if the executive has delivered.
Well, I think, Stephen, certainly we have made considerable progress. I mean, I'm extremely proud of the work that both Andrew Muir and Naomi Long have been doing within the executive, for example, taking forward important streams of work in terms of protecting our environment, building a safer community, working with the PSNI to stabilise pay and police numbers, dealing with issues in Loch Ness. And I think that work has been really significant and is welcome. I think there have also been examples of the executive working collaboratively together in terms of tackling issues like public sector pay and settling industrial relations, and also ring-fencing significant amounts of money for investment in childcare, which we know is a cross-executive priority. So yes, there has been progress. But I'm also conscious, Stephen, that some of the conversation today will be celebrating the fact that the executive is simply still there. I think that is the least that people can expect. And so my focus is on what can we do to reform how government works to ensure it can deliver more and better.
There will be bumps in any government. I get that. But you mentioned in the middle of that, Owen, the PSNI. The chief constable was undermined, told off for trying to fight for more people. That's an example which isn't exactly a shining glory of how it should have worked. He was belittled, he was written to, he was told that he shouldn't do it again in front of others. Is that really a government fit for purpose?
Well, no, Stephen, I think you're referring to letters that move between accounting officers within organisations, which would happen whether there was a government there or not. I think what is really important is when recruitment...
No, it wasn't between accounting officers. It was a permanent secretary to the chief constable.
Yes, and both are accounting officers of their respective organisations, and so will correspond on spending controls and other issues on a regular basis. But whilst recruitment was frozen within the PSNI whenever the executive was down, I think the Department of Justice and Naomi has worked collaboratively with John Boucher and his team to ensure that recruitment can restart again in recent weeks. And I think that is progress, and that is hugely welcome. But this can't be the ceiling of our ambition, Stephen. I mean, so much of the conversation has focused on the fact that government is simply still there. And if we reflect on the past year, there have been a number of scandals, any of which would have been sufficient to pull down and topple previous executives. We need now to guard against that, to sit down with the UK and Irish government whilst the sun is shining, it's time to fix the roof, to ensure that no single party can again pull down our institutions, but to also deal with the pace of decision-making within the executive, because it's true to say that decision-making in a whole range of areas has been too slow. The Environmental Improvement Programme is an example of that, when it took 6 months to get through the executive. So we need to look at how we can reform Stormont to ensure that decisions can be taken quicker as well.
And at least, Jim Allister, despite your best efforts, there is local accountability. I'm able to speak to someone like Owen Tennyson and challenge him about what he's doing on behalf of local people and indeed his minister and his party, Naomi Long. You don't want that local accountability at Stormont, and surely it's better like that.
Stephen, really? 1 year on, not even a programme for government, and this is supposed to be a working government. But like, there's much more fundamental issues here from a unionist perspective. Stormont was brought back on the foot of DUP lies, that the REC border was gone, that the pipeline of EU law had been cut, and instead, as the years gone on, we've shown those to be demonstrably untrue. And instead, what we have is unionists and others implementing colonial-like foreign laws made by a foreign parliament, which happened to be, and it's not without significance, the exact same laws in 300 areas as governing the Irish Republic. So the Stormont was brought back on a con from a unionist perspective, and that con remains, and indeed has got worse, because now we've been told that no changes can be made under the Murphy Review unless they pass a national
it's interesting.
Which was never offered to unionists.
It's interesting, Jamal, so right at the very top, you're having a pop at the DUP, whereas today...
Well, it's interesting that I'm interested in the constitutional position. Well, surprise, surprise.
Well, whereas today, many people are talking about how the country is being run, education, health, waiting lists, the roads, and holding Stormont accountable for what it has or hasn't done. There's a lot more to this country than the DUP and the REC border, Jim.
Well, but constitutionally, there's nothing more important than the fact that we are now a colony of the EU, ruled by laws we don't make and can't change, and our constitutional position has been drastically and detrimentally affected. But let's talk about those issues. Waiting lists, no better. State of our roads, no better. No programme for government. Public finances in a mess. You know, where is the success? There is none.
Owen?
I hear talk.
Let's
let
Owen respond to that.
I hear talk about money for childcare, etc. The truth is, Stormont was given over 50 million. What they did with 30 million of it, I've no idea. They only spent 25 million on a childcare.
Well, let's let Owen Tennyson respond to this.
For public money.
Owen.
Stephen, if Jim invested as much of his time and energy in health and education and housing and
don't you worry about me.
Issues, perhaps we would all be in a better position. Because
perhaps you'd be further on the way to United Ireland, which would delight you greatly.
Of course, I didn't interrupt you, Jim. If Stormont had been functioning consistently, I mean, ministers have been playing catch-up over the past year for work that hasn't been done in five of the last 9 years from people like Jim and even Sinn Féin as well in the past pulled the Assembly down. So we need to learn that lesson. We need to learn that lesson to ensure that we can consistently make progress and deliver. Yes, there are areas where we could do better. And yes, having an Assembly and Executive isn't just about delivery, though that is the most important thing. It's also about accountability. So on those issues around, for example, our wastewater infrastructure, I don't think there is sufficient action being taken by the Department. Alliance has been holding John O'Dowd in that ministry to account. On healthcare...
And have they got anywhere?
Well, not yet, but we will continue to make that argument and press and challenge the minister. That is what democracy is about, taking that argument into the chamber and then going out to voters and ask them to make change. And in healthcare, Stephen, we have been challenging that the reconfiguration plan for our hospitals doesn't go far enough. So that is what having an devolved assembly is about, to make progress.
Well, is it? It's not just about challenges, it's about delivering.
It's about both. It's about both, Stephen, and that's my point, is that where we have the opportunity to deliver, we are doing that. But where we see that there are challenges, we don't hesitate.
Which is more than you're doing, Jim, sitting at the sidelines, sniping, trying to bring it down.
You can try and denigrate me as much as you like. I don't care, Stephen. Join the bandwagon. But let's be very clear. Good, workable government works on the basis of collective responsibility. The last few minutes from Owen Tennyson have demonstrated the very absence of that. He says, here we are challenging infrastructure. Here we are challenging some other department. You know, the way this department, the way this executive works, they're in government, but they're also in opposition one to the other. There is no collective responsibility. Of course, it goes right back to the fundamental that this system will never work because it's headed by a party that doesn't even want Northern Ireland to exist. Never mind work. But, you know, Alliance make my point for me. There is no collective responsibility. They're only interested in their own fiefdoms. They're only interested in challenging each other. It's not about delivering good government because there's no collective responsibility and never will be.
What would you do with health waiting lists, Jim Allister?
Well, I would be in a situation where we wouldn't have this failing, perpetually failing government. I would put it up to Westminster because they hide behind.
So you would pass the buck. But my question is, what are your ideas to get people off waiting lists?
Let's be clear. Westminster hides behind devolution. They say, here's your pot of money, spend it as you will. And when they can't spend it, when they can't organise themselves, then they say that's
But you're not offering
problem.
Any thoughts, Jim, as to how we in Northern Ireland would improve.
If you'd let me offer you a thought, if we didn't have Stormont, then there could be no buck passing from Westminster. And we would have to have provided a national health service at least of equal performance as the rest of the United Kingdom. It's because we do have Stormont, because it can't handle it, that we have an underperforming health service, which is out of kilter with what's happening in the rest of the United Kingdom.
I'll let you respond to that, Owen.
Well, Jim, I think, has exposed that he doesn't have a plan, but thankfully some of us do. The first thing that we need to do is continue to make the argument. The first thing that we need to do is continue to make the argument to the UK government that Northern Ireland has been underfunded. We have made progress. We've signed the interim fiscal framework, and that has delivered over an additional £400 million for the executive. So funding is part of it, but it's not the only challenge. We also need to do transformation. The Bangor Review was commissioned in 2016. We haven't had government for significant portions of time since then.
But you have for the last year.
We haven't got government.
Absolutely. We have. And so that is why I believe the time has passed for the Health Minister to be consulting on general principles around hospital reconfiguration. He actually needs to bring forward proposals. We also need to look at issues like multi-year budgeting to enable the Health Minister to plan better.
It's not just about other ministers, though, Owen. The barristers are out on strike under your minister, Naomi Long's watch.
They are, Stephen, and when you're a minister, you have to take decisions. You don't always bring every stakeholder with you. But Naomi has actually taken forward a significant programme of access to justice reform, and that has proved challenging with barristers in particular. But Naomi has taken those difficult decisions to make progress. I mean, if you look at the Department of Justice as an example, it has been historically underfunded, and yet just this year there was an independent review in terms of one of the prisons which got a fantastic appraisal. So that shows what you can do whenever you have ministers consistently in a department who are committed to that transformation agenda. We don't shy away from those tough decisions. And yes, we do have an obscure system of government where parties are both in the executive and holding one another to account. That is the system that we have, and we won't shy away from calling for other ministers to take the decisions that we think are necessary to deliver better for people in Northern Ireland. But it is far better, Stephen, that we are able to have these conversations and debates within the Assembly, and that local accountable ministers have that power than where we previously were, where all we could do was bring our hands.
Sorry, I do have to make this point, Stephen. Mr. Tennyson talks about us being underfunded. It was the Alliance Party who were the cheerleaders to get back into government without any extra funding. They couldn't wait to get back into the ministerial limo. They didn't care about whether there was an adequate financial package. And now, of course, they've discovered that they've got buyer's regret because they went back into an executive without an adequate funding. And, of course, the Westminster government had their measure. They knew that being in government was more important to them than having working government. And therefore, they went back in without an adequate financial package. And now they're reaping what they sowed.
And if we had followed your fool's errand, Jim, there would be no executive and no additional money for public services.
Could there be no farce of government such as we have at Stormont, which is not delivering and which will never deliver?
Jim Allister, Owen Tennyson, thank you very much indeed. Right, over to you this morning, 03030 80 55 55. Jane, the first call of the day. Morning to you.
Good morning, Stephen. I'm a bit croaky. I want to say something. What have they delivered? Nothing. Absolutely nothing.
Well,
for you. Wait, just let me bear me out for a moment. The only thing they have delivered is for themselves. Nice, big, fat salaries. And as far as O'Neill and Pengilly are concerned, O'Neill, just because they're not tearing the hair out of each other, they think this is wonderful. And no matter what O'Neill says, Pengilly is a nodding noddy. She just smiles and nods. But we haven't got any government. We're taken into the Assembly. We're rushing back to get into government.
Let me give you just a couple of examples. Cross-party consensus on an initiative to tackle violence against women and girls. So that's achievement. It's just not true to say nothing.
Well, right, what have they done?
A bill officially recognising sign language in Northern Ireland's coming next month. Sorry, it's actually coming this month. So you can have a pop all you like, but at the end of the day, some things have been delivered. Right, it's for you to say whether it's enough.
It's not enough. You go down to the doctors, hospitals, education, you name it. There's been nothing.
All right, so what would your alternative? What would direct rule bring?
Get rid of that first up at Stormont.
What would direct rule bring? Or what would a United Ireland bring?
Well, look at the mess we're in. Donaldson took us back into that first up at government under lies and untruths, and they've been exposed.
Right. So it wasn't just Donaldson. Party officers within the DUP signed up to telling the public the REC border issues were all but sorted. It was not just Sir Geoffrey Donaldson.
He was the main leader.
There was a meeting. And some of the party officers within the DUP, enough of them signed up to the DUP selling you that message. And you had to be fair to them. You had the likes of Sammy Wilson in the House of Commons. You had the likes of Nigel Dodds. You had them very clearly giving speeches saying, this is not as white as what the party is suggesting it is. It's not. So don't fall for pinning all of this on Donaldson.
We were told a pack of lies. And that's why they went back into government. We were assured everything was hunky-dory. And that was, I can never forgive somebody for telling a lie. I can forgive somebody for making a mistake. But this was deliberate.
If we come back to the issues, there was money, 25 million, wasn't it, for childcare. That was sorted. Is that another example of how Stormont has been delivered? Or at least it's a step towards sorting it, Sammy. Morning.
Stephen, I want to talk about the things that affect everybody every day in this country. And none of them involve people like Jim Allister or your last caller. Housing. We need somewhere to live. 19,000 people housing stalled because we've no sewers. We need to pay £100 per household and allow the water service to borrow money on the stock market. Let me finish, Stephen, because my battery's going to go dead. Number two, health. We don't need a consultation to tell us that we need one health authority, one set of administration and people to make the hard decisions. Number three, education. We don't need 120 schools with empty seats. We need fully integrated education where we don't have educational apartheid. And maybe in 30 years' time, you'll be out of business, Stephen. Let me finish.
Well, the education. Well, it's not a monologue, is it? To be fair, the education minister, Paul Given, was on the programme.
He was on the radio. And you didn't interrupt him, did you?
He was on. In fact, I did. He was on the programme on Friday saying that you should not denigrate those schools which are not integrated because many, many schools without the title are, is what Paul said.
Number four, Stephen. The economy. The Windsor Framework could make Northern Ireland the Singapore of the North, but instead of looking at the options and the opportunities, you continually broadcast Jim Allister saying, rip the whole thing down. I'm 60 this year. My entire life, I have been denied opportunities by people who put flags up lampposts, and I am sick, sore, and tired of it. And people like you, given people that promote this type of sectarian discussions on the radio show for ratings.
I think you're talking about an elected MP.
You're part of the problem. You are part of the problem, Stephen.
Sammy, you're entitled to that. We also have you on this morning. So what if we look forward over the next 12 months, what would be the biggest priority for you? What would you like to see them do? The biggest thing they could do to make a game-changing change here?
Well, just say, we need multi-year budgets. We do not need multi-year consultations. I'll put that out to consultation. And then the consultation comes back.
Yeah.
And you're less than a year away from the election.
It's a
fit. And you all go back into the trenches and stuff. And like Stephen, he says, Justice, that's your minister. It's a mandatory coalition. Every decision that's made in Stormont is made by all four of them parties. And every one of them has let the people of Northern Ireland down.
It's a fair point. It's a fair point you're raising around the questions of a multi-year budget. You know, how do you recruit for the likes of health? How do you recruit for the likes of teaching when you know that all of the training that goes in nearly takes as long as a first year, takes longer than a first year that someone will have in their employment? So if you don't have multi-year budgets, how do you actually plan for the future? If there's no programme for government, what are we facing in the next 3, 4, 5 years?
I think it's going to collapse again, Stephen. And if it doesn't collapse, it'll stumble on. And we're looking at 2027 to 2032. And you hear me panting. I could be gone by then. I too much weight on me.
Sammy, thank you. Thanks for calling us this morning, mate. We'll hear from you soon again, I'm sure. Paul in Belfast. Morning, Paul.
All right, Stephen.
Good morning.
Stephen, look, I like to agree with a fellow put previous about housing. Now, see, you're born on the Ballygamartin Road or you're born on the Whitechapel Road. You're discriminated against in 1869. Both communities were discriminated against. Housing was terrible. If you're lucky, you get it. You couldn't afford a car, very few cars about. You struggled to get a job. You weren't going to get, if you didn't get that grammar school, you didn't get university. Now, I'm going to tell you something. 1969 to 2025. You can't get housing. Housing waiting lists are bigger. Now we have waiting lists in the hospitals, which we never used to have. I'm the same age as you, Stephen. I was born on the other side of the road from you. I'm going to tell you something. See, unless you went to grammar school at your age, you didn't do well in life. I remember saying none at all. My grandfather was saying none because he had the same name as me. My father was saying none. I was saying none. My brother was saying none. And my cousins were saying none. But this is the point I'm making. Same on the same day. Every one of them, extremely intelligent, well-educated, couldn't get work.
Paul, I want to give you time this morning. Will you stay there for me? And I promise I'll come back to you, because clearly you've loads to contribute this morning. The Deputy Leader of the Ulster Unionist Party, Robbie Butler, joining us today. Good morning, Robbie.
Hi, Stephen.
Has it been a good year?
Stephen, we started from a very low base because obviously we had the Stormont Stay in It for 2 years, which came on the heels of a post-COVID recovery, on the heels of another Stormont Stay in It for 3 years. So the low base that we started from, if you measure it from that, has probably been good, but we're about 5 years behind where we should be. So anything that's being delivered now is being delivered late, and unfortunately the reality of that is impacting on people's lives.
Let's look at cup half full. Sell the big achievements of year one Stormont to me. What have they been?
I'll obviously I'll bat from the Ulster Unionist perspective in terms of health. I think people out there were very glad that we took health, given the performance of Robin Swan initially, and then obviously since Mike's come in. So obviously the first thing we did was settle the pay award. There's been a rollout of multidisciplinary teams in primary care. There's been a social care package put together of circa £17 million plus. Mike has outlined, and I listened to your last contributor there, and he's absolutely right in some senses, that there is an inequality in health, particularly in and around poverty, and Mike's shifting left into that space. So it's going to be a slow climb out of it, but in reality, and I've said this repeatedly, I've said it for a number of years, we need that stability in Stormont, and then we need to gain the credibility. And credibility will only happen when we get the trust of the people back through delivery, where people can feel it.
The latest waiting list figures show that 500,000 people, more than 500,000, are waiting for a first consultation with a hospital consultant.
Yeah.
Now, for those people, how are we going to deliver? Let's pivot this to the next 12 months.
Okay.
If you've got money, I'll tell you what you're doing. You're buying consultations in the private sector. If you don't, what is Stormont going to deliver, your minister going to deliver over the next 12 months that will be game-changing for working-class people in this country?
Yeah, and ultimately as an MLA, and I'm sure all 90 of the MLAs will receive emails and phone calls from our constituents in this very matter, and this is something that we've tried to speak in about. So, for instance, whilst there has been some success, as I know the minister was unsuccessful in a bid of around £135 million to tackle the waiting list, so there wasn't enough money to do that, but that was a priority for the minister. And I'm not sure if you're aware of the scheme that did run previously, and it was called the Cross-Border Reimbursement Scheme, which is where people were able to go south of the border and pick up some treatment there, and then it was reimbursed. And again, that was something that was turned down by the executive. So what we will do as the lead in health is to keep knocking the door of the finance minister, the executive partners, to try and prioritise this, because, Stephen, the waiting lists are impacting people's health. And I know I heard Jim a little bit earlier on, and I mean, Jim's right. Jim is very often right in terms of the technical fact. But in reality, it's not just fiscal failure, it's political failure when we don't have Stormont here, which is why we have the lists that
we have. But Robbie, if we listen to what you're saying this morning about health, and I understand why you're talking about it, your Minister Mike Nesbitt has that portfolio, but surely there needs to be a bigger picture view as to if even more money goes to health, and it's already taking the most of any department for understandable reasons, then what do you do with the money that's so desperately needed to increase policing numbers, that's so desperately needed for the Department of Infrastructure, Department of Education? Surely there needs to be a collective approach to how we cut up that pie. And what is your party's decision on that? What's your thinking on it?
There's absolutely no doubt about that. And I think in the mental health space is probably the best example where the recovery from the mental health issues that we have at the moment isn't just about health. It is about tackling poverty. It is about looking at addictions. It is looking about the inequalities within our society. And those, and again, education is going to form a massive, massive part of that. But there is another reality here where and you'll see this evidenced in the health service in particular, where in year, through actions taken by Robin Swan and then Mike Nesbitt, but there's been £200 million of savings, because that's been a direct. It's not just about bringing money in, it's about what are we doing? Are we getting better value? And then you're getting it right first time. So we have to look at it in the two senses. So there's the intervention, which will require the money, but we also have to look at how we prevent things from happening, which in the longer term will save money. But in reality, Stephen, I'll go back to this. Our starting point was 5 years without Stormont. We were funded below need, so our starting base was very difficult. Any politician that at the moment who is suggesting that bringing Stormont down and not having Stormont and not having politicians operating from Stormont for the best interests of the people of Northern Ireland are sadly barking up their own tree.
Robbie, thank you. That's the Deputy Leader of the Ulster Unionist Party, Robbie Butler. The opposition, the official opposition, the SDLP's Colin McGrath, will be on in the next few minutes. First news time at 9:33. 0330 80 55 55. Colin McGrath from the SDLP with us this morning. And then lots more of your calls. 0330 80 55 55. I keep on saying this is not, certainly in the Nolan Show, this is not just about looking back. This is about you saying to your political representatives up in Stormont, what do you demand they make as their priorities over the next 12 months? That great big white building up in the hill. What do they need to prioritise? Well, Colin McGrath, you may be the opposition holding them to account, but your party should have ideas as well. What should the priorities be going forward?
Well, Stephen, I think, first of all, it's important to recognise, I think the best line that sums up the Stormont and the executive at this stage 1 year in was on the front page of the Irish News today, where it said, room for improvement. I think what that is pointing to is the fact that there has been some work done over the past year, but not enough, because it's not impacting people's lives and it's not drilling right down to be able to assist people where they need that help. And I think it is well rehearsed in terms of what those issues are. They've been mentioned on your show so far in terms of needing to challenge the health service to get it back on full function. We need to sort out stuff to do with education in terms of school infrastructure, our water service. We need to get fixed up so that we can get building again in our communities. So those are the things that we need to do. But whenever you're asking me, what would we as an opposition do in those things?
Well, before I get to that, and I know I asked the question, but you're tempting me here. So if we take those three areas you've talked about, health, what is your party's proposals for how you would improve the Department of Health? What would you do?
So what we would do in terms of all of those things is it's about a credible, prioritised, time-bound and funded plan. Now, the thing is that
all of
those...
But what would your plan be?
Yeah, okay, but if you give me a second, Stephen, calm down.
Sorry, it's Monday morning.
I know, too much coffee this morning. I think what the issue is that there are individual things that can be delivered there. All of the ingredients are there. The money is there in terms of transformation. The ideas are there from the people that are working down on the ground in the organisation. It's about bringing those together and putting them together. Our health service does need to be transformed, but we're not seeing any swathe of plan that comes together and here is what we're going to do. We're going to transform our hospital networks. There is a small plan for that, but it's completely different from what we're going to do in our primary care. It's different from what we're going to do in our community pharmacy. There's little attention being paid to our dental services, but bringing them together as one credible plan across all of the executive, we're not going to be able to do everything. And that's the problem with this executive. It tries to say that it's doing everything for everybody, and as a result, it does very little for anybody. That is what needs to be changed. Prioritise the things that need done.
I'm not sure I got a specific of
health. We would transform the health, and we would put down a credible plan that shows a roadmap that would bring about the changes that we would like to see. That plan, if we publish plans and work with other executive partners, and Stephen, would be a very detailed plan. It's not something you're going to do in 2 or 3 minutes in a radio show, but transformation is the main theme, and it needs to be delivered and funded, and we don't have that. We don't have a plan that says, this is what we're going to do, and this is when we're going to do it, and here's the money.
And this is a genuinely open question, Colin, because I don't know. But has the SDLP put together a written detailed plan? Because one of the questions today is, I think it's a fair question, how effective is our opposition? You are the official opposition. So rather than say what's wrong, or as well as saying what's wrong,
absolutely,
is your party putting together policy papers in front of the public to say, look, this is what, in each of the departments, this government should be doing? Is the SDLP doing that?
So yes, we have that. We have a series of policy papers that are on and developed over the last year on our website that can direct to things like childcare, things like regional imbalance, and there are some papers on the health service. And there's more to come. I'm attending a series of visits at the end of this week to see how other places are delivering the transformation, because I don't get a sense that our executive is reaching out to other places to learn from them and bring those back. But the thing is, we are 8 members of an opposition. Yes, of course, we need to be credible by coming up with alternatives. But at the end of the day, the main job of an opposition is to hold the executive to account and highlight whenever they are not doing their work. They are the people that have thousands of staff. They are the ones that have millions of pounds to be able to develop policies. Those policies that they deliver have to become legislation. Stephen, we're a legislative assembly that is sitting with essentially 3 pieces of legislation 1 year in. So that means that this executive isn't using the legislature to be able to deliver for people. That is a failure, and it needs to improve. And we are tireless for standing inside the assembly saying, when will we see legislation that we can scrutinise and exercise our full role of as an opposition work with people to try and improve that legislation?
And finally, Colin, what's your sense of the mood in the assembly and in the executive? Is there enough stability that we can build, or is it in trouble?
No, I get a genuine sense that the people that are here and willing to work to try and improve things. But that is a sense. I'm a backbencher in terms of those are the MLAs that I speak to. Our greatest concern is that the executive is maybe not working at pace to bring about the delivery that we need. That could point to there being some disagreements between the main parties in terms of agreeing legislation that can then be led in the assembly for us all to address. I don't see much action in terms of a legislative programme. We were promised it by the First Minister before Christmas. It doesn't seem to have materialised. That will be, for me, a key litmus test as to whether or not the executive is going to deliver for people.
Thanks for being with us this morning, Colin, the SDLP MLA, Colin McGrath. Paul, we promised we'd come back to you. Good morning again.
Good morning, Stephen. Stephen, look, I don't mind being caught up with politicians that have power. I don't mind you bringing people on in front of me that have real power. But our politicians has been proved. Since we voted for them, we want the change. Not just people killing each other. We want the real power. See, in 1969, when people had no power, there were no politicians fighting for them. They lifted weapons and fought for themselves in the working class areas. Now, you go into them exact same working class areas, and you will see the exact same poverty, the exact same housing crisis. And I'm going to tell you something. Our politicians have no power, because they have no tax-raising power. There's no power to change the banking system. See if you live in a poor working class area. See if you go on the credit line. See if you go on the credit checks to see if you can get a loan at a bank. Bank will never give you a loan worth talking about. They'll never give you a hand up. They'll give people with money a hand up, but they'll never give people from working class areas a prop. They'll never take a risk on them. And I'm going to say another thing too is,
Gordon Lyons was talking about changing this housing thing, the housing list, and about the intimidation points. Well, I'm going to speak to Gordon Lyons now. You listen to me, Mr. Lyons. You listen to me. See, when you have your housing executive doing checks on people and handing them points on a score on a points-based system, no, do you need to look at? You need to look at the last population check. What do you call that? Or the last what?
Census.
The last census. Take a look at it and look at how many people are living in single one-room dwellings and two-room dwellings with no children, couples together, maybe single people. The amount of single people, grown men and women, are living with their parents in every area of Northern Ireland. Because you know why? They'll never get on the housing list. They'll get no points, nothing we're talking about. They need to look at the way the housing executive hands points out to people, because too many men and women are having one child and jumping to the top of the housing executive list, and they're single men sitting on the housing executive list for 15 years, living with their mother who's a pensioner or their father, and they can't get housed. And because their job isn't bringing in a big enough income, and where they can go and pay for private landlord rentals and that. Constantly being priced out of the market, and the safety net in this country now is falling apart.
And do you think, Paul, if you look at the alternatives that we talk about so often, direct rule, a united Ireland, do you think that your prospects would be any better if there was no Stormont and there was direct rule, or indeed there was a united Ireland? Like, what? How easy is it to get a house in the south?
Listen to this, Fred. You're handing me two options. I'm going to give you a third option. The first two options are non-existent. People in our communities will not agree to them. But I'm going to tell you what they will agree to: a Northern Ireland that works. And I'm going to tell you something. Doesn't matter if you're Shankill Road, or Ballygunmartin Road, or White Rock Road, or Andy Town Road. I'm going to tell you what you are. You're discriminated against, generations of you. And see, until we come together as a one people in this country, and tell Gordon Lyons to change that housing list, to address people, men who are sitting for 15, 20 years on a housing list, can never get housed.
But isn't the whole point, first of all, there's a lot of responsibility beyond Gordon Lyons, but isn't the whole point of devolution that someone like you, Paul, through a radio program here's your power.
I have no power.
You know who to challenge. Your power is, under devolution, there's a locally named minister, Gordon Lyons, who you're calling out. You wouldn't have that if you didn't have Stormont.
No, but this is the point. I'm not saying that to have Stormont. I'm saying Northern Ireland has to work. British government doesn't work. MPs go over and sit in the House of Commons and have no power we're talking about. There's Sinn Féin sitting down there, down south and south of Ireland, and the two main parties that despised each other are now one party that keeps Sinn Féin out. I'm going to tell you, the people of the north need to come together. The Shank on the Falls and the Mount Pottinger and the Short Strand, they need to come together. I'm going to tell you why. Let me finish what I'm going to say. Forget about health. Forget about health waiting lists. You say there's a health waiting list at the minute. Will you go and you speak to any private health care company now in Belfast? You ask Gemmins how long their waiting lists are now starting to increase. Do you see the way that's starting to go? And I'm going to tell you something, Stephen. I'm going to tell you this. See if I sit on a housing list for 5 years, 6 years, or 7 years, and I'm out working every day and I can't afford to have a roof over my head. What part I have? I go to my politician to fight my corner. My politician, not by their own fault, they're powerless because they can't raise money, they can't tax, and they can't create tax-free zones or reduce tax on companies that intention to come here. Can't do it. They've no power. They're powerless. Power they have.
I'm not trying to be clever with you, but they can. They do have some power-raising measures, and I'm not trying to be facetious with you.
I know you're talking about the rates and stuff like that.
Well, there's the rates where they chose not to lift the cap in its totality. Who does that protect? Protects people like me in big houses.
Stephen, you're not to blame.
They chose not to introduce prescription charges. They've chosen not to introduce water rates. Been local decisions here,
Stephen,
where they've ruled out tax-raising powers.
Car tax. There's 2 million private cars in this country, privately owned. 2 million. Now, they're bringing in massive tax changes here in April, the British government. Massive tax changes on cars. We should be allowed to be able to tax our own cars. Because okay. I can tell you now, the vast majority of people keep their car before the tax. But let me okay. say this again. Let me say one thing. Gordon Lance, you need to look at that housing list because it's a disgrace the way it's numbered for people. It should be the longest people on it should be housed, not people jumping the list. They have one shed
okay.
or two.
Paul,
people who are on it the
need to leave it there a minute. Thank you very much. Thanks for calling us today. Let's listen back to some of the big issues which have dominated the political landscape since Stormont's return last year.
Casement Park is an executive flagship project. It will be delivered. I think that we need to see the British government honouring their commitment to a funding element towards that.
I am not a magician. I do not have a blank cheque where I can get money together and just say, yes, whatever it's going to cost, here is the money.
PSNI budget is not adequate to cover all of the issues that they need to cover, and that is why I have argued that we need additional resources in justice and in the PSNI.
I'm well aware of the police numbers here in Northern Ireland, but those decisions are taken by the executive. As I've said to you before, whoever is in government, with the budget you've got to decide what your priorities are.
So there needs to be a safeguarding review with regard to who knew what, when did they know it, who did they tell, and what did they, the individual or the organisation, do about it?
There are, I think, lessons to be learned for a lot of people here in terms of due diligence of an employer who takes on an employee, for example. And I think everybody needs to learn those lessons. But in terms of my actions, in terms of the employment of these individuals and these references that were given, they would not have been okayed on my part. I never would have okayed those references, and had I been asked, I would have said so. And that is why the two people are no longer employed.
Over the next 10 years, the numbers of children that we're projecting that is going to need special support is going to rise by thousands.
It was never there to solve the problem of winter pressures, because those pressures cannot be solved. It's almost an obsolete expression, because those pressures on EDs are now 365.
Well, tonight, members, that the dress code is smart. Now, some of you have a very loose interpretation of smart. And I would encourage members to dress smartly when it comes to the chamber. We're not demanding that people, gentlemen, wear shirts and ties, but we're asking to dress smartly.
Just some of the issues we've been talking about together here in the Nolan Show over the last 12 months or so. Stephen and Antrim. Morning, Stephen.
Hi, good morning, Stephen.
Good morning.
That last segment that you played, if it were a school report, I wouldn't want to be taking it home to my mother. It's just dire listening to it again. But the whole reason for lifting the phone to you this morning was your opening segment with Jim Allister and Owen Tennyson. And they have something in parallel, believe it or not. And that is, Jim Allister will rightly point out that Northern Ireland has become subject to a lot of European legislation and laws for which we can do nothing about. Okay, we are essentially impotent as far as the EU is concerned. But the same situation exists here for us, the ordinary people. I listened with interest to Paul's lengthy contribution, and I'm sure it resonated with an awful lot of listeners this morning. But here's Paul's problem. That is, the whole concept of this devolved administration, the executive and the assembly. We can't have mandatory coalition and expect progress.
Well,
it just doesn't work.
Well, you say that. Stephen and Antrim, thank you. Commentators Chris Donnelly, Alex Kane with us today. Morning, Chris. Morning, Alex.
Morning.
Good morning, Alex. Well, Alex, look, Stephen and Antrim there and some of our other callers talking down the potential. But is the potential not what the political parties want it to be?
Well, in essence, it is what the political parties wanted to be, Stephen. So that's why it's worth saying.
that if you gave the DUP a choice and you get the Sinn Féin a choice, they would rather not have this government. The DUP would rather have a direct rule from through the UK, and Sinn Féin would rather have a United Ireland, a government through a United Ireland. So both of them are in this difficult situation where they're administering a government which they don't really have their heart. There's no particular, you know, political emotion and commitment to this.
Have they done well, though, over the last year?
Well, you know, when you said they've done well, they haven't done... Well, I'm not sure that they have, Stephen. I think the problem is that part of it's been they've been down so often. You know, it's the old cliche, they've been down more often than they've been up. They still have difficulty. I think the big problem is, Stephen, collectively, and this is actually all of the parties in the executive, collectively they don't have a coherent, agreed vision of what Northern Ireland should look like, of how it should run, of how the money should be spent. And the priority, sorry, one other point, it's worth making this statement. You cannot prioritise 30, 40 or 50 issues. You can only prioritise and make huge progress on a handful of issues. And this thing they say, oh, we must do this, this and this. They leave so many things untouched, Stephen, and so many things uncompleted. And it creates the mess.
And Chris Donnelly, how you prioritise issues, it's called a programme for government. You wanted to be in Sinn Féin. You were you're a former Sinn Féin candidate. You know, how come this towering, powerful party, Sinn Féin, hasn't been able to deliver for its voters a programme for government with the others? Not talking about a United Ireland, but talking about what issues are going to be a priority and how are they going to be delivered. Is it embarrassing for all the political parties, Chris, that there's no programme for government?
I don't think it is. I think people understand the constraints of the system within which our politicians operate very clearly. I mean, Alex laid it out. We have, for instance, we're watching in tandem, you know, we had elections in the South recently. They've now got a government in up and running, but it's based on government almost of the willing. So the two political parties, as well as a group of independents, have come together and they can forge, even though they're different parties, they can say, look, we're going to agree on something. The difficulty with up here, obviously, is you're entitled to be on government because of the nature of the power sharing arrangement.
But are you justifying that the people do not have a programme for government? In other words, because some people might not know what that means. In other words, a roadmap of an agreed list of priorities that the government's going to work on. How is that not embarrassing?
Well, here's the problem, and I think people understand this. The different political, and I'll give every politician this. They go into politics to make a difference. The problem, Stephen, is they all have a different idea of what the difference is they want to make. So when you throw together four significant political parties, and remember, we're used to five parties being in there. The SDLP just didn't get enough seats at this time. It becomes more problematic. Now, yes, I do think that the bar of expectation that we set as a society for the executive is far too low. I get frustrated. As someone who works in education, trust me, I get frustrated with what I see happening at the moment. But I do understand the difficulties that when you put four parties together and force them in their room, it's very difficult to get a shared unity of purpose. I do believe that what has been interesting over the last year has been that clearly at the executive office level, I think there has been an agreed purpose to present a uniform, a view of something of the two leading voices, Emma Little Pengelly and Michelle O'Neill, of having a unity of purpose. And I think that from their own perspective has been important. I think that's been received well. But again, I come back to what I said earlier. We have a very low bar for expectation. Well, so what you pointed out is out in wider society isn't really something that people are surprised
Alex
by.
Alex Kane, there's a piece that's just gone up online on BBC News Online with after an interview with Emma Little Pengelly and Michelle O'Neill. I think it's our political editor, Anna McClafferty, who's sitting down with them today, interviewing them. Emma Little Pengelly, our Deputy First Minister, is saying we've made a really strong start. And both the First and Deputy First Minister is saying strong progress, significant progress in the first year. Is that fair?
I think it's fair in a sense, Stephen, that given that it's Northern Ireland, given the troubles we've had, the fact that they have managed to keep the show on the road.
Well, that's not significant progress. What's the significant progress?
I'm not sure that's what I'm saying. I'm not sure there has been significant progress. I think it's what I'm saying, Stephen, that the nature of Northern Ireland, that simply keeping the show on the road is as progress. But if you drill down into that, if you get any department you want to look at, you will discover they will. The ministers will tell you. You interviewed, I think, was Paul on Friday.
Paul Given, the education minister.
Yeah, he set out the fact that there's still a huge array of issues he hasn't dealt with. But the problem is, and it's a simple problem, but it's worth bearing in mind. For example, the Irish Coalition, which was formed, took a few weeks to get it together. They agreed the programme for government. Then they got the vote to become the government. In Northern Ireland, the parties just get in to do the haircut, right? You, if you want to be in, you can be in. It's then after that, they try and get the programme for government started. We're still, Stephen, at this point, a year later, we still have the programme for government in some form of consultation. The parties will then have to reconsult and so on. I just want a situation, I've told you this before, Stephen, for years, instead of sitting back to 50, 70, 90, 100 projects, sit back with 10 or 20, give each department 4 or 5 of them, agree in the mandate, which is until 2017, agree in the mandate to do that and just actually say to people, we would have liked to make more progress in some issues, but look at the real fundamental progress we've made because we have agreed to do it.
Chris Donnelly, how effective are the First and Deputy First Minister as a duo? Maybe in comparison to when we had Paisley and McGuinness, to when we had the other leaders at the top.
Yeah, I think their performance, and again, I think that their role is a more symbolic one, but symbolism in this society is very important. I think what has been striking over the last year has been that clearly there has been a deliberate effort from the DUP's end to go along with that idea of a partnership at the top. I think Sinn Féin are much more comfortable with that. Sinn Féin have bought into that over a longer period of time. They actually saw that it actually is perceived from their own community as a strength, whereas I think the DUP were much more wary of it. But given the weakened position that the DUP have found them in over the last 12 to 18 months, I think they thought, look, we have to go along this road. So I think Emmeleta Pengelly has done well at it. But I do think, okay, I'll come back to this. I do believe disillusionment can set in very quickly in our society if we do not see delivery of the executive.
Chris, thank you.
The symbolism has happened. We need more now.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you, Alex. Here comes the news at 10.
Get the news. Make the news.
Good morning, all. Claire Hannah and Matthew Toole from the SLP are currently talking at Stormont. Outside Stormont. Let's dip into this and hear Matthew O'Toole speaking.
Changes to the ministerial code and the pledge of office. We're happy to take any questions.
The health minister
say, accept. We'll see.
Do you give any leeway to the executive who say they've been hampered by a tight budget? There's also been a change in government.
We missed what Claire and Matthew said, but journalists now asking questions. So let's stay with this and we'll get some
Do I give leeway to them? No, because they sought office and they took the pledge of office in here last year. It's not about me giving them leeway. I'm not their mum or dad. What I am is the leader of the opposition. I acknowledge where there are limitations and constraints on their ability to act. It's a devolved administration and it's a mandatory coalition. But let me say this, Vicky. We heard in the committee from a Department of Finance official a couple of weeks ago. Last year was the biggest ever financial settlement for the Northern Ireland Executive. The biggest ever. Yes, there are financial constraints, but last year was an opportunity to invest in healthcare transformation, to invest in wastewater infrastructure, to set a course for the rest of the mandate. They didn't do that. They simply didn't do that. That isn't me being negative. It's simply me doing my job as an opposition leader. They're marking time, but as I said, our job, and as Claire said, our job is not simply to hold them to account for the things they do, it's to challenge them the things they're not doing. And my gosh, there's lots they're not doing.
I think everybody understands governing is difficult, but with that sort of a surplus, while you can't fix all of the problems, to allocate, I think, less than a 1% of that budget for transformation to try and make the subsequent years of the mandate less pressure is unforgivable.
So that's Claire Hannah and Matthew Toole taking questions from journalists. We'll keep across that for you if anything more. Oh, Matthew's saying he's getting an appraisal from Claire Hannah. Rebecca Harper is co-founder of Melted Parents NI. Morning to you, Rebecca.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. So you're all about childcare, of course.
Yep.
Have they delivered? And what would you like to see out of them over the next 12 months?
I think, Stephen, it's been an okay year. You know, we've seen the introduction of the Northern Ireland Child Care Subsidy Scheme, which has helped some families. But at the moment, we just can't afford to sit back and celebrate that without thinking about what's next. For parents, that means fee rises right around the corner in April. Some parents are reporting to us up to 20% fee rises from their providers. So we need urgent intervention for the government to expand the Northern Ireland Childcare Subsidy Scheme as well as long-term reform. Or really, at the moment, parents are just back to square one.
Well, expanding it, of course, takes money. And what from Pivotal, that's where you come in, not just for childcare, but the wider overview. Have they any realistic chance of getting a lot more money, or have they got to realise what they have is what they've got to cut their cloth with?
Morning, Stephen. I think it's important to realise the executive has just got a really big financial settlement from the UK government in the budget that was back in the autumn. So if we look at the new financial year starting in April, they've got a 1.5 billion uplift. They've got the highest settlement they've ever had. So I think they have to look at that amount of money and say, how are we, as we move into our second year, going to start to make a difference for people? So they can't just let that money plug the gaps.
They've got
to really start transforming how services are delivered.
You talk, Anne, about that big, massive financial settlement that they got from the British government. If you listen to Good Morning Ulster this morning, the Health Minister, Mike Nesbitt, was talking about potentially dipping into next year's health budget to pay for what he wants to do this year.
Yeah, I think that's how he's going to manage to make his pay settlement this year, by paying some of it from this year's allocation.
How does he pay it next year, then?
Dipping into next year. Well, he's using this year's money to pay most of it, and then he's kind of going to pay some of it backdated later. And that, unfortunately, means there's less of that increase is going to be available next year.
Exactly.
What worries me, Stephen, is that you've got a new government in Westminster, and they've got plenty of difficulties of their own. But what they have done is they have given a big injection of public spending right across the UK, and they're using it in England for big infrastructure projects, for improvements to public services. They're trying to make a huge difference there, and I am worried that here we're going to get our Barnett consequentials, which is a fair allocation. We're going to get our Barnett consequentials, our 9% increase in our budget, and it's just going to plug the gaps and not actually make that much difference. We do have a real one-off opportunity with this extra money next year, and we do have to use it properly.
And when you say next year, do you mean this year?
No, I mean the year that starts in April 2025, so the next financial year.
Yeah, next financial year, but this year, April 25. So
yeah.
What would you like to see them do?
I think your programme this morning has really shown how people are not seeing the impact from the executive being back. They're not seeing much difference in their day-to-day lives. So I think the executive has to do two things. First of all, it's got to improve the public services that people are experiencing, whether that's being able to get housing, really importantly, being able to get access to the healthcare system, GPs, emergency departments, consultants, appointments. It's got to improve people's experience of the education system, particularly those who've got special educational needs. So it's got to make a difference that people can actually feel and see day to day. And then the second thing it's got to do is it has to start addressing all these long-term issues that have been neglected, like wastewater infrastructure, like health service reform, like our transport system. We have not invested in those over decades, and we have to get onto that now and stop sticking our heads in the sand about it.
I understand why health will dominate any media discussion when you're looking at whether a government has performed or not. But sometimes the poor child in this, so to speak, is something which affects so many working class people, so many people from low income groups, and it's housing. And I just wonder if housing dominates enough headlines over any given year. And there is a disconnect, Anne, between those people and their dilemma of any given year is should they move up? Should they change their house into an even bigger house, or they're sitting on a bigger house and should they downsize and release the cash to buy a car? And meantime, or a holiday, and meantime you have people sitting on waiting lists, people squeezed in to properties which are not fit for purpose. Is housing dominating this government's agenda enough?
Yeah, we tend to think about health first and foremost because it's more than 50% of the budget now, and then we tend to think of education as the next biggest thing. But housing, you're right, housing is an absolute foundation in anyone's life. If you don't have a stable home and a warm and a safe place to live, then that makes your life extremely difficult. And I think we have, you know, over the years, it's another issue where we have underinvested, and we know now we've got, I think, 47,000 people on the social housing waiting list, which is a huge number. We've underinvested in housing, and we now have a crisis in house building, whether it's private house building or social house building, because of our wastewater infrastructure, and we're in many areas actually houses just can't be built, which is a really serious situation that has to be addressed.
So is this administration prepared to look at the planning system in Northern Ireland? You've got NI Water saying they need an extra £1 billion to increase to improve the water infrastructure. If that water programme, you talk to many developers throughout Northern Ireland, they're ready to go, except they can't get the planning permission. Why can't the planning? Sometimes the planning permission comes through, but it has a stipulation on it that there's got to be a water supply and connected to the sewage system, and it doesn't happen. So what is this government, what is Stormont going to do about our planning system? What's it going to do about the water problem? Or are we going to be here in 12 months' time, Anne?
Wastewater infrastructure is one of the things that needs to be right at the top of the list. This is a huge problem for house building. That means new houses aren't coming on stream, whether that's social housing or private housing. That's impacting on whether people can get housing. It's impacting on the affordability of it. So those problems with wastewater infrastructure have to be right at the top of the list. It's not glamorous. It's not particularly interesting, but it has been neglected for a long time, and it really must be addressed by our executive.
And well, thank you very much, Rebecca Harper. Let me come back to you, your co-founder, Milton Parents NI. If there isn't any more change in the next 12 months, where does that leave childcare? Where does that leave parents?
Parents are in an absolute crisis at the moment. We had a GP contact us last week who said that she couldn't afford to work more than 3 days a week because of her childcare bill. Every single issue that we are talking about today comes back to childcare. It's, you know, we won't have an economy if half of all the workforce has to leave because we can't afford our childcare bills. If our government don't expand the Northern Ireland Childcare Subsidy Scheme and deliver a radical strategy that actually addresses affordability, regional balance, accessibility for parents. It's not just parents that are affected by childcare. It's absolutely everybody who calls in. And we hear this argument, you know, don't have kids if you can't afford them. But without our children, we don't have future taxpayers. We don't have future workforce. We can't afford. It's already too late. But the executive can't afford to sit back and go, well done us, we did the Northern Ireland Childcare Subsidy Scheme. It's already being made redundant because fees are rising so extortionately that parents just are trying to survive at the moment, and without further intervention immediately, but also an actually deliverable childcare strategy, we're just in crisis.
Rebecca, thank you. 030 30 80 55 55, an opportunity this morning. This is the biggest platform there is in Northern Ireland to talk about the news on radio, to talk about what affects your lives. So use it. Use the biggest show in the country. 030 30 80 55 55. If you don't want to listen to the programme at 9 o'clock in the morning, it's on BBC Sounds throughout the day. Just search for The Nolan Show. Nolan Live coming back on television Wednesday night in a fortnight's time. David in North Belfast. Good morning, David.
Hello, Stephen.
Go ahead.
Sorry, just a couple of wee points. Colin McGrath was on earlier on, and you asked him a question. He never answered it. If he's got aspirations to try and run the government over here, surely he should have costed plans set out and show to people what they're going to do if they want to be in the government. And secondly, housing. There's two-bedroom houses on streets off of Ballyshannon, two-bedroom houses, and the rent for people £600, £700 a month, near double what a housing executive would be. I think what Stormont should do is put a cap on these private landlords, because they're making an absolute fortune out of people who haven't got anything.
You put a cap on landlords, and that might disincentivise landlords from buying the properties in the first place. David, thank you. Let's head to Fermanagh. John, morning, John.
Good morning, Stephen.
Morning, go ahead.
I was listening to the contribution in your show this morning. Particularly, there's a lady was on earlier on, and Jim Mannister, and there was other ones as well, talking about the situation regarding the government in Northern Ireland. Well, I have something to say. I think that where we are at the moment is where we're going to be, whether we like it or not. I don't believe that the British government are going to change. We hear these people talking about they don't want devolution, they want being run from Westminster. Well, I can assure you that's not going to happen. And can I just say...
What's not going to happen?
It's not going to happen that the devolution will be taken and we'll be run from Westminster. That's not going to happen. And can I just say, Stephen, I happen to be over at a family funeral in England, and I have an in-law who's actually a Conservative MP. We talked for a long time about Northern Ireland.
Who's that?
Oh, I'm not going to name any names, Stephen.
Spit it out. Who is it?
Sorry?
Spit it out. Who is it?
Oh, no, I'm not going to spit it out. As I said to you, I want to give you the point of what was said. He said in the British government at this minute in time, the DUP, when they came to the decision regarding going back into government, that the DUP did have absolutely no say. It was there, take it or leave it, right? And the situation is at this moment in time, whether we like it or not, this is what it's going to be. We're not going to get any more money from them. We've got to make the best of what we are getting. And that is the situation.
Well, I wonder, do you downplay your leverage? You look at the appetite that there is for news and politics in Northern Ireland. There are hundreds and hundreds of thousands of you that consume the Nolan Show in any given week. There's a huge appetite for news and current affairs from the population. And then those political parties with years and years of experience of fighting governments, of fighting, and they know how to negotiate. The question is, are they creating enough leverage for Northern Ireland? Are they delivering enough for you? John, thank you. I want to move on. I want to have a look back again at taxis and bus lanes. We've been talking about this non-stop on the programme, haven't we? At the moment, bus lanes on Bruce Street, Dublin Road, Great Victoria Street, Shaftesbury Square are open to most taxis in December. Stormont's Department for Infrastructure made the decision in an effort to ease traffic congestion to let the taxis in. Well, the head of TransLink said last week, we covered this, that he's got concerns about more taxis being allowed to use some bus lanes in Belfast. And look at this in response, Stephen Anton from Phonacab. Morning, Stephen.
Morning, Stephen. How are you?
I'm all right. One of the biggest taxi companies there is in Northern Ireland. And you're no doubt going to tell me how brilliant it is that taxis can get priority and many others can't.
Well, I'm going to tell you how well it is, but I'm going to back it up with some facts. We have been monitoring our business. We always monitor our business, but we've been looking at how our taxis get across the city centre zone since the introduction of bus lane access back in 18th of December. And we can tell from the stats how quick we get to our passengers, how late we get to our passengers. And we have seen quite a marked improvement because taxis have been allowed into the bus lanes.
And Stephen, I do want to hear from you about those stats, but I wouldn't be doing my job if I wasn't pointing out that you're a self-interested group. You want your taxis to be in these bus lanes, and there's no independent scrutiny of the figures that you're about to give us. So you're giving us your figures that you say, but these are not BBC figures, and they're not arm's length figures. But I'm interested in hearing them.
Okay, well, first of all, in terms of us being a self-interested body, that's right, but we don't want to do anything that's going to put any other road user at risk or put any other road user slowing them down on the road. We have to work along with all the other road users and make sure that we contribute and we don't cause any problems like anybody else. So we have an interest to the public as well, to ourselves. As far as the stats go, well, Stephen, we've invited you up here before. You're welcome up here to review them at any time. But you're right, these are specific to Phonacab.
So how many people were surveyed and what are you suggesting it shows?
Well, we've done a number of different things. First of all, we have taken a look. Most taxis these days run dispatch systems which allocate where their bookings come through and where the drivers go and so on. And where you have Great Victoria Street there, that's what we call our central zone. And we have looked at transiting through the central zone since bus lanes have been opened up. And two things that we have found is, number one, if you book a taxi for right now to get picked up in the central zone in and around Great Victoria Street, our taxis have been arriving 26% faster than before we were allowed access to the bus lanes. And the second thing that we have found is that whenever we've looked at someone who's booked a taxi in advance, 29% of our taxis are arriving quicker. So we're getting 29% fewer late bookings than we were before. So we're seeing a marked increase. And this isn't our feelings. These are what the stats of our existing journeys are showing us. We're seeing a marked increase in efficiency and we're getting to more passengers.
So if I take the first stat, you're saying that your taxis are 26% faster in that zone. Is that what you're saying, getting from A to B?
We're getting to our passengers 26% faster than we were before.
And surely the material point here is that with the extra vehicles, the extra cars in those bus lanes, how much, if any, is that slowing down the buses?
Well, a couple
which,
of things
which you
are,
don't,
first of
and
all,
you don't have the data around that.
The last time there was a trial done in 2017 around taxis and bus lanes, it was the DfI's report afterwards which said that, if anything, buses actually ran more efficiently. There was no detrimental effect on bus speeds during that trial. And we haven't seen anything either, because as well as looking at the actual journey stats, we also keep an eye on any customer service issues that we have, any social media messages or incidents, anything that's reported to us that way. But you can also comment on Photocab through Google and TripAdvisor and other different platforms. And since taxis have been allowed into the bus lanes, we haven't had one negative review, we haven't had one negative social media comment, we haven't had one complaint about either buses being slowed down or cyclists being affected negatively.
There is a wider discussion to be had. I keep banging on about it, right? Which is my experience when I'm travelling abroad and things. Look, maybe taxis should be allowed in bus lanes, and that's clearly what you're pushing for this morning, Stephen. Or maybe there should be a criteria that it's not, you know, the taxi industry, but maybe it should be how many people are in the car. Like, do you think it would be fair, a taxi with one passenger getting to a journey 26% faster than someone that's proactively putting four or five people in their personal vehicle and dropping different people off at work? Should they be sitting in a lane that doesn't get priority and your one passenger does?
Well, a couple of answers there, Stephen. First of all, do we want to be in bus lanes? Well, we want the opportunity to find what the trial actually says. Previously, whenever the last trial went in 2017, one of the comments was that while there was no downside to taxis being in bus lanes, they wanted the trial to run longer to give more meaningful results. So if we run this trial through 2025 while Durham Street remains closed, and if it turns out that the stats say taxis shouldn't be in bus lanes, well, we have to accept that. We want to try and find a more efficient way to move our vehicles and all vehicles around the city centre. But if it turns out that that doesn't work and there is no advantage, we don't want to be in bus lanes. So it isn't a foregone conclusion. As far as allowing taxis into the bus lanes and not anybody else, well, whenever we wrote to the Minister before Christmas in support of letting this trial go ahead, one of the things that we proposed at the time was that taxis should only be allowed in bus lanes if they were either on a journey or on their way to a journey. So they couldn't just use this, they're going to pick up their missus after work. It had to be a case of making the most of the opportunity to be in the bus lanes.
Well, you're allowed to be in the bus lanes at the moment. So are you self-policing what you say you wanted the legislation to do? Are you instructing your drivers that if there's no passenger in the car or they're not on business, they should not be in a bus lane?
No, because that rule was not put into play by the minister as part of the trial.
Yeah, it wasn't put into play by the minister, but you're saying you want to do it, so you can issue instructions to your drivers. Why not practice what you preach?
One of the things you find when working with a taxi company, Stephen, is that drivers will do things that any other driver, whether they're driving a Mini or a Mercedes or whatever, we all have incidents on the road. We all have things that happen to us while we're out there. But once you put a taxi sign onto your roof, you become much more noticeable in terms of your behaviour, let's just say.
Okay.
So one of the things that we did do with all of our drivers, as soon as this trial was announced, we said that there would be increased scrutiny on the industry, there would be increased scrutiny on drivers to make sure that we were not affecting other road users in any detrimental way. And because of that increased scrutiny, we have put increased scrutiny on our drivers to make sure that they're performing correctly.
Stephen, in a nutshell, you're asking the minister to consider allowing you to drive in the bus lanes all year to collect more data. Is that it?
Well, yes, for two reasons. First of all, because the minister did promise a longer consultation than they had in 2017. And secondly, because with what's going on with Boyne Bridge and Durham Street at the minute, it looks as if that congestion in and around the city centre is going to be for a little bit longer than was expected.
We really appreciate you coming on, Stephen. And Phone a Cab, you come on and you take questions often. So thank you for doing so. Our last story today, we know that today was the day that NIE said that they would have everyone back with power after the storm. We know that as at 8 o'clock this morning, 400 customers remained without power. That's an incredible achievement, to be fair to NIE, but not for the 400 people. So will they be hitting the deadline? Let's see. We'll let you know tomorrow. One of those that was without electric for almost 10 days was Eamon. Morning, Eamon.
Morning, Stephen. How are you?
I'm all right, thank you. You've been without power 10 days. That must be a nightmare.
Oh, absolutely, Stephen. Having to run to friends and family to shower, get hot meals, no heating. It's been horrendous, to be honest with you. And NIE, as in what they have support and contact with you, is basically null and void, apart from the time until I contacted a local Sinn Féin representative in Ahanlon, who's been more than helpful with all the residents on the lane. And then I contacted the BBC, and all of a sudden then everything then kicked into gear, and there was generators and phone calls being coming back, and just completely different from when I was just an individual just phoning up myself.
So I know you were speaking to the Nolan team. We contacted NIE. What have they done for you?
So when I contacted Una, she then made contact with a few of the other residents, contacted NIE, they came back and said that there should be a generator coming that evening, which arrived around sort of 10 o'clock that night on the Saturday. This is after numerous times phoning up and asking, was there any chance of getting one earlier in the week?
Well, fair play. So there's a sign of Sinn Féin as a political party delivering for local people, representing them on the ground, and a delivery off the back of it.
Oh, absolutely. And I'd say even for yourselves, getting involved, that's when everything all sort of kicked into gear. We got our first date for coming on was Wednesday. Then that changed until Saturday. And I know all the engineers were up to their eyes and doing their utmost to get everybody back going. But they actually came to the bottom of the road and connected all the properties up until our lane. Then they drove past the lane and got the properties beyond me all going down into Ballykinder, and we were left just stranded in the middle and nothing been done about it.
Frustrating.
Yeah.
But at least you're back up and going now, right?
Back up and going last night. They arrived at 9 o'clock, had everyone going by 11 o'clock last night. But the actual frustrating bit was there's a piggery down the road that made priority before residents who are on the lane who have medical devices for breathing. There's old age pensioners.
The pigs,
you know,
came before the people, you said?
They had pigs up and running before they actually went and got us going.
Right.
And well, that's frustrating when you're looking down at these engineers up poles fixing transformers for a piggery, and you have a business is on the lane. He hasn't worked. He hasn't done anything. He welds gates and things. So he's been out without power. He hasn't done anything for a week.
Eamon, thank you very much.
Well, you
thank
know.
You for flagging up the story to us. Obviously, we'll be giving you an update tomorrow as to whether NIE set their own deadline. That was a busy show today. You can listen to it on BBC Sound. Tell your friends. Keep talking to me on Twitter at Stephen Nolan. We'll see you tomorrow at 9 o'clock. Have a good day, everyone. And thanks for listening.
The biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet at Stephen Nolan.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. after the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice, and for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.